Sewer program, but nevertheless, I think you put your departure for permanent peace and stability with the Russians had no intention of whatsoever.
Ever. No way. Well, you know, the best answer, the best reflection on that is Kip Bolin has always been sensitive about criticisms of the Yalta Agreement. And Bolin once told me, when he was ambassador to Paris, I was out of office, he said there was nothing wrong with Yalta.
It had been adhered to.
I'm not sure he's right about the first point, but at least certainly the second point, when you say it had been adhered to, well, you, what they agreed to in the Yalta, for example, regarding Poland, if the one was written down, it's broken.
If that one doesn't make an agreement, if you can help it, which depends on the good value of the other side,
that's what we're up against.
But our problem is that whether we have to support treasures and try to be able to remove both threats and send it to China.
See, if Congress says, one, you can't aid the North if they comply. And second, if the Congress says that you can't strike the North if they comply, then what incentive do they have? Then all you have left is first force and being, which is rather considerable now. The South Vietnamese are very tough. They're stronger than the bear. And whatever influence we can have with the Russians and the Chinese, which is also considerable. We still have some involved, some things to play. Tell me what you feel we ought to do in Southeast Asia at the present time. What do you think of American policy? What's your advice?
Well, I was discussing this with Andrew Kissinger just now. First, you must create an air of certainty that your policies are going to prevail regardless of all this cacophony from congressmen, senators, House of Representatives, TV commentators, newspaper editorials. I think this can easily be got across because you've demonstrated to them that when you say something, you mean it. And they're going to see this through it. You've already started a new chapter in history. You're going to write this chapter that goes in. And this chapter, everybody in the East will end more gloriously if there is a South-Vietnamese non-communist government standing up. My assessment of what Southeast Asia chance. If they do not rely just on military strength, because that's exactly what the communists want them to do. The South Vietnamese communists should be treated as South Vietnamese communists, as distinct from the North. And that's the first distinction. The South Vietnamese communists cannot win on their own, not for a long, long time, not unless the social and economic base is eroded and begins to disintegrate. They need the North before they can win. So if I were a South Vietnamese advisor to the U.S., you know, offer these chaps a place under the South Vietnamese sun and very simple level, let them win the government. Hamlets of districts, but never a Czechoslovak situation where the police interior army that's out and wheel them away from the north. Clear distinction made to north and south. And it's not a game which the north alone can decide. They've got to get the concurrence of the Viet Cong to be able to play this game, unless, of course, they want to risk a full-scale, open, overt aggression with all that it means. So if they can succeed in this, then they can slowly concentrate more of the whatever aid you can give them, whether it's $500 million or $600 million or $700 million. They begin to spend more and more on social and economic policies than on this army. The Hanoi and the Viet Cong, I mean, their strategy would be to have more and more of this, if not all of this, spent on armed forces and military expenditure. And then slowly you get the base eroded again. Because people, you see, peace, but there's been no change, no improvement. More casualties, more hardship, more privation. Well, I would say that this is the critical factor, because I don't see the situation remaining standing, and therefore it can go in one of two ways, back to more and more conflict, more and more military expansion, which can only make the situation very dangerous. I think they really have to adjust their minds on what has been before, where the emphasis wants to resist aggression from the north into what is possibly a completely new situation. And there must be an argument in Hanoi as to whether they ostensibly honor the peace agreement, get the aid which can be habilitated and faster than the Chinese or Russian aid, the Soviet aid, but at the same time, of course, also sending infiltrators and arms down the south to keep the pot boiling. Not enough to bring about American reaction, but enough to keep the South Vietnamese economy on a constant war footing. I think President Hugh has got to move away from that by making some bold moves, getting the South Vietnamese a place at municipal level. As part of the setup, I don't believe, you know, Vladimir Putin or any one of the others, who are not so well known as Vladimir Putin, wants to be a functionary in Hanoi. And I think this, they should make this appeal to their desires.
Now, to what extent, looking at American policy, you would say that however, that Hanoi has to deal with their sustainable policy character?
Yes. that's why you get, that's why you use the word certainty, that is what the earlier room said, that it's certain that we may, that we're going to stay here in Asia, or maybe in that area, in a responsible way.
This is where I find it's very difficult to make a prediction of what the end date will be, because they've made so many great calculations before.
Yes.
And reading the American press, hearing American senators,
right,
congressmen, House of Representatives, and so on. And then, you know, government coming out and say, American president, ah, that's a great mistake, you're turning to another Vietnam. They think that this is a tide of history on their side. This is a danger of miscalculation again. But I would think that if I were, and I think they would probably be in the end majority in this collective leadership, that would believe that having gone thus far, you're going to, having started this new chapter, you're going to write this chapter up and complete it in an honorable way. Therefore, if I were there, I'd play safe. But then I know that that is the unpredictable element. There's collective leadership on the other side. Hence, I think the value of both the Canada and the state.
Actually exposing that leadership to the extent we can possibly expose it to, whether it's a Kissinger or others, is vitally important, because from all accounts, except for the UNTO, they are paranoid, parochial, I was talking to one of our prisoners of war back in the 70s, and he said, you have to remember that as far as these leaders in Hanoi are concerned, most of them have been in prison a number of years. He said they knew very well how to work on this, because they knew the mentality of people who were in prison.
Yes.
And, well, as
I said, experience, right? I mean, in social conversations at dinners, it was almost morbid to think that Van Vanton and his colleagues most likely talk about is their prison experience.
Raleigh, what is your judgment on Cambodia at the present time?
I believe that the focus, the principal action is in South Vietnam. If they want to take Cambodia, they run a risk of taking the towns, of having to feed the towns, of themselves being under siege, bombardment, and so on. So I think they just want to keep this up, keep the pressure up, both for psychological and creating problems of logistics and so on. Just keep the pot on the boil, you know, congressmen, they would say, bombing as they do it, and so on and so forth. But the key is still South Vietnam. I mean, they can take Phnom Penh. 12 hours, they've got to get back very quickly. Maybe a psychological boost, but what's the value of that? There'll be no Vietnamese troops that will capture Phnom Penh, no, the Khmer Rouge. And that's no great propaganda victory for them.
Yeah.
I guess they're coming out of just a different thing.
Yes, exactly. Maybe a hated enemy occupied. get the support from our Congress and the American people who we need to maintain a credible defense, and also to undertake abroad the kind of foreign policy leadership which we must undertake. I'm not referring to it in terms of an America dominant in the world or in Asia.
No, but in fact, it means that you're still the anchor man that's on the communist world.
That's right. No, nobody else can do it. I mean, there was a time before World War I, we could say, well, they're the British and they're the French, they could stop the Kaiser. And then before World War II, well, there was the French and there was the British. And after the French were gone, there was still the British and so forth. And now there's no one. Let's face it, the Japanese could do it, but they can't be allowed to. The Germans might do it, but they can't be allowed to. The British and the French can't do it. So here we are. It isn't because the United States wants it. As Mallow pointed out, we're the first great power that became a world power, but unintended to be so. Therefore, we don't have policy checking until recently. But I want you, but I feel at this time that if we cave, that's what the war in Vietnam was about. When I say the war was about, I'm not referring to how we've done it, which I supported. I'm not